Welcome to HealthComm Central, where we unpack theories and frameworks that can help you create more effective communication to improve both health outcomes and health equity. I'm your host, Karen Hilliard, behavioral scientist and longtime communication practitioner. If you're looking for fresh approaches that get real results, you are in the right place. So let's get started. Hello, HealthComm nerds and HealthComm novices, and welcome to HealthComm Central. This week is the second part of my two-part series with Dr. Karen Temerius, an MD and political psychiatrist who is the founder of a group called Smart Politics and the creator of the Change Conversation Cycle, a five-step framework for communicating more effectively with people who are spouting misinformation about science or public health, or who you don't see eye to eye with politically. If that sounds like anyone that you may see over the holidays, then you definitely need this framework. But more importantly, it can strengthen our ability as public health communicators to be strategic in countering pseudoscience and dealing with hostile audiences. If you didn't have a chance to catch last week's show, you may want to hit pause right now and go back and listen to that first. You will definitely also want to check out the links I have in the episode notes for last week and this week to find the interactive online chat bots, also known as the Angry Uncle Bot, developed by Karen Temerius and published in the New York Times and distributed by Kaiser Permanente, that can help you practice this technique with the Change Conversation Cycle before you have to do it with an actual human. Whether that human is your angry uncle, your conspiracy theory cousin, anyone you may see over the holidays. So let's pick up now with Dr. Temerius talking about how important we as individuals can be in changing people's minds about the entire institution of public health.
People are fascinating. Somebody can completely distrust the public health system in the United States and still love their doctor and adore their doctor. And because their doctor, you know, thinks something is a good idea and treats them well, they follow their recommendations regardless of what they believe about the rest of the world. And that's what's really happening.
Thinking beyond the one-on-one conversations that people may be having, although those seem like incredibly important opportunities, not just to have impact on people that you care about, but to practice this exposure therapy, as you were talking about. But thinking now to larger scale applications of this kind of conversation and really listening practice, because that's what I see it as, that the bulk of it is how we listen and respond to the words that somebody else is saying rather than the things that we have pre-planned to say,
right?
Communications pushing out. So looking at larger scale kinds of applications, are there any success stories for how this is being applied to media campaigns or to groups or that sort of thing?
Well, when I think about applying this at a larger level, a lot of times what it means is that you need to start letting an audience know that you really understand where they're coming from before presenting your solution. So you have to do all of these things that the Change Conversation Cycle does, but within the context of your message. And that can be really hard. Somehow that means a message has to make people feel safe. It has to reduce resistance. It has to, you know, let them know they have agency so that they'll really feel empowered with the message you're giving them. It means that you need to show that you've heard them, right? So if you're speaking to a particular audience, you need to name their concerns, not just yours. So frame the problem the way they see it. You need to show that you care about them so they don't just see you as this cold outside, like self-interested force in the universe, like telling them what to do for your own good, not for theirs. And then you need to provide some kind of reason to do what you're recommending. But again, best in the form of a story. Like that is what actually moves people. And in terms of politics, where I see this really happening best is in deep canvassing, has been a really useful force. Motivational interviewing, which has become an increasingly widespread tool, is very similar to a lot of what I teach. But I haven't seen people really crafting messages yet that take advantage of this kind of thinking about how people process information, particularly information that's contrary to their pre-existing beliefs. One of the things that I think we run into that's a real barrier is all of us are taught debate in school, or, you know, we learn the 5-paragraph essay. Those of us who go into healthcare, we're essentially scientists at some level, right? We facts and reason are, you know, a huge part of our way of engaging in the world. And so we have been trained to basically communicate in a way that is the exact opposite of what will be persuasive with people. And so it's really important for us to make that shift. And a lot of times people say to me, but, you know, facts and reason are really important. Like, debate is really important. And my response is, it depends where they're being used. There is a place for argument and debate and facts and evidence and reason. And that's in the courtroom. That's in the field of science. Like, those are places where people are, or at least claim to be, unbiased. That you have a jury that has vowed to look at the evidence with no preconceptions. They've been chosen because they have no preconceptions. And in those contexts, reason and evidence are incredibly powerful for persuading. But when you're talking to someone who has already made up their mind and who at least considers themselves to be well-informed, whether they actually are or not, and considers the issue at hand to be really important, it becomes incredibly difficult to overcome the basically motivated reasoning that you're going to confront if you try to come at them with reason and evidence. So you've got to work through the relationship. The relationship is key. You've got to build trust, and people are much more likely to listen to you once they trust you.
This is a thing that we talk a lot about in public health communication, the idea of storytelling versus facts, that data has a place, but that it should be used very selectively to support something that you're saying, not to actually make the case, that stories should make the case first. And I think a lot of people have internalized that. And yet, it is hard sometimes when you hear someone saying something that is not accurate. And I won't even go to things that might be offensive or hurtful or whatever, but it's not factual. What is a way that you could respond if somebody brought up the idea earlier of people who think there are microchips in the vaccines? So if somebody says something like that, how can you respond in a way that does not agree with that untrue statement and yet doesn't argue or throw more data out there to try to convince somebody?
Yeah, I find that that is in many ways the hardest thing for people to do, is deal with obviously fake information or false information. And what I find most effective is to express empathy in those moments. I often will name the fact that I don't agree, but I won't do it in a way that says you're wrong. It's more of a, huh, that isn't my understanding, but that must be really scary for you, right? So you're very quickly going to meeting them where they are emotionally. A lot of times when someone says something that's untrue, we kind of turn off emotionally. And it's partly because we go in, we get triggered and go into that fight or flight. And when you're in fight or flight, your capacity for empathy just tanks. So finding that empathy in yourself and being able to offer it really creates a connection and lets them know that you're not here to fight with them. You're not here to hurt them in any way. It's about showing them that you care about what happens to them. Because a lot of times when people are talking about these public health interventions that they're scared of, it's because they're genuinely frightened. They really do think that something bad is going to happen to them. It's not just that that's false, it's also terrifying. And if we can help people not be so scared by offering some compassion, it gets them to process those emotions, get to a place where they can actually rethink their beliefs a little bit.
I'm so glad you brought up the thing about fear, because this is something that I think is also important to talk about, that quite often people are driven by fear to adopt these opinions or beliefs, but also that, or even statements that seem a little crazy to us may actually not be that irrational after all, based on somebody's lived experience. And we know, of course, that public health has not always done the right thing, and that many institutions have been guilty of things that would make people not want to trust them. So it's not as though these things are completely made up. You only have to look at, you know, something like Tuskegee to know that things can go very wrong and that this has happened. But it is working through the idea that there are protections in place now and that these things are not happening, and helping people understand what the reality may be now. But it's not totally crazy that they are coming, you know, with these fears, because the history is not perfect.
And it's important to be upfront about that. So often I find, because someone else holds false information, false beliefs, they don't want to acknowledge anything they say as being true. And actually, it's really important sometimes to acknowledge what they're saying and even maybe cite some examples of, yeah, you know, you're right. Historically, there have been some times where there have been some negative reactions or negative results. And you're right. You know, every once in a while, someone does have a bad reaction to a vaccine that sadly can cause a terrible result. Simply acknowledging that can really change the whole dynamic of a conversation. It doesn't reinforce their opinion. It actually softens them, which is, again, very counterintuitive.
I wanted to ask you, because a lot of people in the listening audience also are interested in research, are there any research projects going on right now trying to gather evidence about the change conversation cycle's effectiveness, or anything that you're hoping will be happening in the future?
I would love to do a research study on this, but I'm not in a position to be conducting research on it right now. I think there may be a graduate student at UC Davis who's using it in her dissertation research, but I haven't heard from her in a while. But people are implementing it kind of without necessarily testing it yet. So there's a group in Canada who are bringing it to schools. So it's getting out there, but there is not yet the testing I would really love to see.
Well, and as I tell people after I share it with them and tell them about your work, I always say, you know, even if it has not yet been tested, it's built on the foundation of a lot of well-proven or well-researched behavioral science, behavioral theory in psychology, communication theory about how we deal with hostile audiences. So it's got all of that as part of its foundation, truly. So hopefully some testing will happen, and maybe there'll be even somebody listening here today who's like, yes, I would love to try to implement this in some way and figure out a way to evaluate its effectiveness, which would be very exciting.
That would be really great.
One last thing I want to ask you, just in closing, we're at a very tough point in our country and our culture right now with so much polarization. How optimistic are you that we are going to return to a time perhaps when these differences of opinion don't seem to be tearing us apart as a country as much as they seem to be right now?
I am optimistic. As I see it, a lot of the problems we have at this point are structural, but I also see that there are people working really hard to change some of the structural problems, whether it is the Electoral College or gerrymandering or introducing, you know, ranked choice voting. These are things that actually currently are driving polarization in a lot of ways. And if we can make some of those structural changes, we can make a difference. But ultimately, what is going to drive that are conversations. What excites me most is how powerful these conversations are. Every time I have a conversation with someone who radically disagrees with me, I'm amazed at how quickly I'm able to make a connection and move past all of the negative feelings. My favorite thing pre-pandemic was to get on an airplane and sit next to someone wearing a red MAGA hat. I knew that we had extremely different political beliefs, and to just strike up a conversation. And, you know, invariably it would turn to politics and we would talk about that. And then late in the conversation, I would reveal that I was a progressive from Berkeley. And their reaction is generally shock, that they always tell me, "You're so sane," right? And, well, you can't be that liberal. And I'm like, actually, I'm about as liberal as I come. But that's the kind of conversation that is transformative. And everybody can have these conversations. You know, there's nothing magic about me. I went from being somebody who argued with everybody to being somebody who could have these conversations with anybody. So, yeah, I'm really hopeful because of that.
That's such a wonderful note to close on. And also, I love that you brought up the structural issues in politics, because there's a lot of analogous structural work to be done in public health with changing policies and systems and environments and those kinds of root causes of poor health outcomes for people. And this, again, seems like a framework that could really work well for some of those conversations with community decision makers and policy makers. And so much utility for the change conversation cycle. And I'm so delighted that you were able to come and talk with us about it today. I am going to be putting links in the episode notes where you can find out more about Dr. Tamarius's work, where you can find links to the Angry Uncle Bot just in time to practice before you join up with your family over Thanksgiving or other holidays that are coming up in the next few weeks. And I hope that maybe we will have you back at some point to update us on how your framework and these ideas are being used not only in politics and public health, but maybe elsewhere. So thank you again for joining me today. I really, really appreciate it and hope you have a wonderful holiday season yourself.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great to be here.
Wow. I am so excited that I had an opportunity to talk with Dr. Tamarius, and I want to thank all of you for listening to this series. I'm really excited about the potential that this framework could have to help us through this period of polarization and misinformation in public health, not only as we apply it to conversations, but to messaging and interventions as well. And I hope it's inspired all of you to maybe give it a try over the holidays as you gather with loved ones. To all of my U.S. listeners, if you're celebrating Thanksgiving with family and friends this week, safe travels, happy feasting. If you're on the road and have a moment of downtime, I'd be so grateful if you could leave a rating and review for us. That will help other listeners find us in the future. Again, thanks so much for listening, and please join us next week for another episode. Until then, be well, stay safe, and stay science-based. Bye for now. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment now to leave a rating and review. Be sure to subscribe to HealthComm Central on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you have friends and colleagues who should be part of our community, please share the link.